There are some skills that I think I picked up during my PhD was resilience and patience. Of keep trying and trying and trying, and at some point, you know, something will work, but to keep trying with the solution. Like the modeling part is much later. First, just understanding what is the problem that we should be working on requires a lot of strong analytical skills.
All right. So hello and welcome everyone to whoever is listening to this particular podcast. I have with me today on the podcast, Dr. Aparna Taneja. She's a software engineer at Google Research working on a lot of AI for social good projects. And we'll be talking to her more in detail about her work at Google Research and how she's making an impact for AI for social good projects. So it's good to have you on the podcast, Dr. Taneja. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a bit about your background? Like before you joined Google, what was your background of expertise and what was your interest point in AI? How did you get started with AI?
Okay. So my interest started during undergrad. I started at IIT Delhi and I did my bachelor thesis in image processing. And then I ended up joining a research lab right after graduation. Working towards image processing related problems for automobiles, basically, you know, lane detection, pedestrian detection, collision avoidance. And back then we had the traditional stereo camera setup, getting 3D maps. So my journey started with actually computer vision, and that's what got me excited. And I then applied for a PhD. I did my PhD at ETH Zurich under Professor Mark Wolfface, who is like a pioneer in the area of 3D reconstruction from images. And that's where my journey started. I did not do the traditional ML deep learning PhD. My PhD was like completely on 3D computer vision, image-based localization, reconstructing large-scale 3D models, detecting changes, geometric changes or structural changes in 3D models using images and so forth. After which I actually did a brief postdoc at Disney Research in Zurich, again on similar topics, image-based localization and so on. And after that, I moved to Google. After a few years at Google Zurich working with the Maps team, I moved back to India and I was back in research. So at Google Research India is where my kind of official journey in AI started. And at first I worked with the Earth Observation Science team and using ML for satellite, ML on satellite imagery for climate related problems. And now for more than 2 years, I've been with the AI for social good team.
I see. So, I mean, you are one of the few people who have seen both the ends of ML enigma. I think a lot of people, I think, like me, who got interested in AI where the field was at peak of its expertise. I think started, like, I completely feel overwhelmed because it's hard to even catch up with the field because we don't know where it started from, and wherever we are getting started, it's like already people are progressing very fast. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's good to know. And what kind of projects did you initially worked on at Google Research? I think you said like you worked on satellite imaging and all those kind of, like, was it related to Google Maps in some ways, or like what was the application of it and what kind of works did you explore over there?
Right. So this was with the Earth Observation Science team, and the goal is to use AI ML on satellite imagery, publicly available satellite imagery. My specific project was part of a bigger project called Dynamic World, which is actually publicly available now. The goal is to do land use, land cover detection. So given a satellite image, being able to label each pixel as whether it is sky or water or shrub or a building and so forth, you know, a well-defined data set of 9 classes. And this was done using publicly available Sentinel-2 imagery. The motivation was to release this on Google Earth Engine for everyone to use and build upon. And so far, before this existed, I think most such products were either to buy for, like, it's too expensive or the resolution was 30 meters from landside satellites. And this was the first of its kind, releasing a publicly available such data set at 10 meters resolution. And then I also explored the use of active imagery, not just traditional RGB imagery, but also active imagery to help learn better where there is, for instance, images, cloudy images, but active imagery can see through it, so you can still have some information where your traditional RGB images would not have much meaningful information. So that's the project I worked on there.
I see. And do you see, like, as in, like, have you, like, I'm not sure if you have worked on this, but, like, after the advent of AI, like, I mean, I'm sure Google Maps is using one of the few of the most sophisticated AI right now, but have you seen the accuracy being improved using AI? Like, as in, how, what kind of techniques would you say previous people used before the advent of AI? Like you said, you worked on much more of manual, I wouldn't say manual, but as in like much more computationally rigorous processing tools that required human inputs. But nowadays, like you have like lots of annotations tool that can be predicted using AI. So how have you seen this particular transition of before I would say 2014 kind of advent in AI?
So I guess I personally did not use annotation tools as such. What I do see is that with the large amount of images and the large amount of not just labeled data, but tons of unlabeled data. So of course, like you said, right, with so much data, you cannot potentially annotate no matter how many tools you have, because the accuracy is also important at some point.
Yeah.
So you're right. There is definitely value to, you know, human labelers marking some images and then a tool quickly picking upon it to mark similar images quickly and avoiding the need to label each image manually. So that definitely helps. But the advances in like semi-supervised learning and unsupervised learning is what lets us use much more data than what we could have used in the past, where we always needed input and output labeling.
Makes sense. And then how did you transition to your current team, which works on AI for social good? Like, what was it like? I'll get to the transition and then maybe I'll also ask you more about like, what does this particular team mean? Like, what do we mean by AI for social good? But let's learn more about like, how did you make transition from vision-based projects to AI for social good?
Yeah. So I think I started out with vision-based projects thinking, because that's my, you know, background with my PhD and everything. But this team was building up and I just found the work very exciting. And then I had chats with Professor Milind Tambe, who is leading the team. He's a professor at Harvard and jointly director at Google. And to me, it was just mind-blowing that I could do interesting and exciting research while having such kind of direct social impact. That's what really drove me towards working in this area.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, as in, like, what are the overarching definitions? Like, as in, what kind of objective this particular team would have? And what kind of projects does it entail?
Right. So we have recently rebranded ourselves as Multi-Agent Systems for Social Impact. So because AI for Social Good is a very broader, term. And so we're specializing in using multi-agent systems techniques for real impact in the social domain. Broadly, we work with .org. Together with .org, we conducted this workshop back in 2019, where we invited NGOs and academics, and we conducted this matchmaking workshop. So the NGOs would come up with proposals of where they needed AI to help address certain problems, and academics with their research background, and we did a matchmaking to see, you know, who would go well together. And we started these three-way collaborations, and I think six projects were funded as part of the 2019 program. And then we did, and that went pretty well. So in 2020, there were some reinvestments as well as another program where 30 NGOs were funded as part of the program. And of course, with so many projects, we're a relatively small team. We couldn't be part of all the projects, but we are deeply, like, personally involved in a few of these projects. Broadly, the areas are public health, agriculture, and conservation. And one of our strongest collaborations has been in the area of public health, specifically maternal and child health. with an NGO called Arman in India. We've also had very good collaborations with Khushi Baby, again working in the maternal and child health domain based in Rajasthan in India, Health Mom, which is based in Nigeria in India, and WCT, which is Wildlife Conservation Trust for Human Wildlife Conflict Prediction. To name a few. I see.
And something what I hear interesting is, like you said, like a lot of NGOs make proposals to make use of AI. So like, just to get like more clarity, as in like, is it true that NGOs are looking forward to AI? Like, because the reason I ask is a lot of people would be very wary of AI, using AI in their particular tools, because they might not be very confident of AI tools because they are still not that much mature to use in real world scenarios. So have you seen a lot of like increase in exploring AI for that particular use cases?
Yes, so there is definitely an increase in awareness around how AI can benefit everyone. You know, like we've seen that there have been tremendous advances in AI. I mean, I can't remember from my first year of my PhD to now, like there have been 5 or 10 different trends already.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a lot of awareness around how it can be used, and it is becoming more and more accessible to everyone. And so the NGOs are not expected to fully understand what AI can do, but they would come up with interesting problems of where they feel is something could be useful if they have a specific problem. If they have the data to support the problem, then it's up to the AI magicians to figure out how to make that link. So
yeah.
Yeah, but it can be daunting for, I can understand for people who are not in this area, it can be daunting to imagine what problems are solvable. So many a times, you know, we would also see proposals where it could be like, you know, people think there's some magic and no matter what problem we present. So it is difficult. Similarly, it's difficult for us. Our expertise is in AI, so we don't understand the community, the real problem, the data. And that's where we rely on the NGOs, the domain experts, to help us build solutions that are actually meaningful. So it's a good learning experience.
Yeah, true. I really agree. And the reason I asked that question is like, if you see the ratio of published research versus how much that makes to the real world scenarios, because I work with a lot of doctors, but like most of the time when I visit Mayo Clinic over here or like any kind of institutes, you never see actually these kind of tools being used in real world scenario. Like when we say we are proposing an AI model for diagnosis, like, but how many people are actually using that for screening patients? Like it remains always like a proposal or like a very ambitious tool on the back of your head. So it's really nice. And one of the articles that I read where your team proposed the Saheli project, and it actually goes on to, like, I think you said, like, they reached 100,000 users, like 100,000 users, and your goal is to reach around 1 million users by the end of 2023. So that's really good. Like, even if, like, in those cases, I would be less concerned about accuracy, but, like, even if it is making some kind of impact, so that's a very good thing. So I mean, kudos to that. Well, like, I mean, we'll be covering that like in detail. But I'll let you maybe introduce the Saheli project, if that's okay with you. Like, can you tell us what exactly Saheli project is and how did it get started? Like, what was the problem statement for you guys from a real world perspective, and how did you guys transform that particular to AI research statements?
Right. So Arman is the NGO that we work with on this project, and they were one of the first round of 2019 projects, and they came with a problem that they're focused on improving maternal and child health outcomes for underserved communities in India. And they have this program called M Mitra, which sends out automated voice messages about pregnancy and infancy to women, so throughout the 9 months of pregnancy and 1 year after birth. And these messages are timed according to gestational age. This is basically to increase awareness and knowledge around key health issues. So if you're 4 months pregnant, they will remind you, you are due for your next checkup. Remember to take iron tablets. If once you've given birth, remember to take your child for immunization at month one, and so on. But they noticed that even though lots of women are enrolling into the program and initially they're listening to the messages, eventually they start dropping off from the program. And they did a study to show that actually listening to messages can have phenomenal impact on health outcomes for both the mother and the baby. So listening to these messages is really impactful and critical. So how do you retain these women in the program? And normally, their health workers, they would have a support center, and the health workers would call these women. But you can imagine this is like 200,000 women just in this program alone, which is in the city of Mumbai and its suburbs. It's not feasible. Like if 40% women are dropping off, you just cannot possibly reach out to every woman and ask them why are they not engaging, explain to them that it's important to listen to their messages and so on. So that's where they wanted help. Can you help us figure out who should be who should be called, because we only have limited calls to make every week. So this is like a perfect computer science problem, right? It's a standard, it's a limited resource allocation problem, basically. The resource here is the health worker's time, basically. You can only make, let's say, 1,000 calls a week. So which 1,000 women do we call at a given week? So this is like a resource allocation with a sequential planning, because this has to be done every week. And this is where we came up with this restless multi-arm bandits approach, because our maps have been used traditionally very well in such setups of limited resource allocation with sequential planning. We developed over several iterations a model, which we then first tried in simulation. Then we did a real-world field study together with the help of the NGO, which with over 23,000 women. And this model showed improvement in engagement by 30% compared to the approaches that the NGO had been using so far. So that's how the journey started.
I see. Is it
some fireworks happening for some reason?
Okay.
Somebody's celebrating something. Maybe a cricket match has just finished or something. So Saheli is what you mentioned, right? So Saheli is actually the name of the model. So we actually, after we did the real world field study and we were fully sure that, this works well, we worked hard on actually then transferring the model to the NGO for deployment on a weekly basis. So this was then integrated with the NGO's framework and runs through cloud. And that this model is what is called Saheli, which in Hindi means friend. Yeah. That's how it came to be. And it has now served over 150,000 women so far already.
Wow, that's really cool. I mean, the scale is really big. So I think whatever impact it has, like it either scales to like a big number. But just to understand, like so these kind of messages, like you said, like for example, let's say we are just pushing out 1,000 voice calls a week. But in that case, so what is the goal? To pick out the most likely person that would be dropping out of from the program? Or is it like finding the best set of people from which you can propagate your information without making those calls? So like, what is the objective over here?
Right. Sorry, I missed that part. Yes. So the goal is basically, because you have only a few calls to make, we have to do it very strategically to get the best output possible. So we looked at past listenership data. So we have access to whether, when the automated voice messages are sent, for if the call was answered, for how long did the beneficiary listen to the message and so on. And there are some examples of when these interventions have been made in the past. And then using this historic data, we try to learn which women would benefit from receiving an intervention or not. And based on that, so this is, if you were to solve it brute force, it would be an intractable problem to solve with so many combinations. But there's this approach called the Whittle Index approach, which has been a traditionally used method with RMAPs, which basically kind of gives you, for each beneficiary, the value of how much benefit you would get from acting on this arm versus not. And it kind of gives you a ranking on the benefit. And then naturally, since it gives you a ranking, you can pick the top K winning, whatever your K is, K being your budget at any time. So yes, the goal is to call women who are at a high risk of dropping off from the program and would benefit from receiving this service call. So pick those women.
I see. And what was the intuition? Like, why? How did you guys stumble onto resting multi-arm bandits? Like, did you have any failure points of like understanding which techniques would work? You started off with, let's say, approach one, and then it did not work, and then you iterated towards other approaches that were already out in the literature. Like, did you have any of those kind of iterations towards different algorithms?
So initially, we started with the basic LSTM model. And the problem with that was it would, while it would detect which are the women who are at a high risk of dropping off, that number would be quite high. And when you have a small budget, then who do you pick amongst these? You know, it would detect that 30% women would drop off. Now, who amongst these 30% women should be called right now? You know, because there is an urgency within that 30% as well. So that didn't work out so well. We tried an online approach, but given that there was very limited data around the active sample, it takes a long while to learn precisely. But this was done in simulation, not on real data. So it takes a while to actually reliably learn which women would benefit versus not. And here, not only do we need this ranking of which women should be called, but there is some sort of an urgency as well, because once women kind of drop off or have, they can even officially drop out from the program, like they could just call the NGO and say, stop sending me messages.
Yeah.
So you want to call, you want to make an intervention before that happens. So you want to be able to use a model that can learn rather quickly to act quick enough as well. Given that limitation, and like I said, given the structure of the problem, like with the limited resource allocation problem with a sequential planning aspect, that's where riskless multi-arm bandits fit quite well naturally.
I see. And how do you guys evaluate the effectiveness of this approach? Is it like, do you focus solely on the metric that, okay, how many people are still enrolled in the program, or like how many minutes of calls these people are holding up? Or do you also evaluate the impact of health, as in like previously this was the fatality scenario of like percentage in terms of whatever the health is versus it has improved? Like, what kind of metrics do you focus on?
So far we had been focusing on the metrics you mentioned earlier, like engagement with the program. Are people listening to longer and longer messages? Are people dropping off less or much later? What section of people are listening have benefited the most? So typically women who are from the weaker section of society with limited education, limited income, are the ones who seem to benefit quite a lot, because they are the ones with the most limited access to information. I mean, a lot of these women don't even own their own phone. It's a shared phone that just shared across the family, or the husband owns the phone. So the women have very limited access to the phone as well. So we really noticed, we also did these subsections analysis as to which groups of women are benefiting the most from such interventions. We also did a fairness evaluation that the model should not learn to through biases in data or due to noise in data discriminate against any minorities. So we did a fairness evaluation as well. The focus was a lot on the engagement metrics. And you're absolutely right. The final goal is to, of course, have improve health outcomes for the mothers and their babies. There is a study ongoing right now to measure that impact. It's not easy because it's not a direct measure. There's not a direct relation. So even though in the past, the NGO has already done a study which showed that for women who listened to all messages, there was an improvement in the health outcomes. What we have shown is that through the AI-based interventions, engagement improves by a certain percent. How much would that lead to increase in health outcomes is yet to be inferred. But what we are discovering in the process of the study is that improvement in engagement leads to improvement in behavioral outcomes. Like, women know they should take iron tablets. Women know if there's something fishy, they have to go to the doctor for a checkup. So that increase in awareness has led to behavioral changes. They notice their diet, they know they should exercise and not lift heavy things and so on. This in turn leads to impact on health outcomes, but it's not a direct impact. So it's the correlation gets more and more difficult, but we are trying to measure to see how much of that impact translates to the health outcomes in the end. And in some cases, it's very difficult because despite their best intention, sometimes some women don't even have the means to improve the situation they're in. So that improvement is not possible despite their best effort or intentions. So, but we are trying to measure that cascading effect of impact.
Yeah. And one thing that comes to my head is, like you said, like you want to scale it to, like, let's say 1 million users or maybe one people who would be reaching out. But in that case, this would also limit like the number of workers, right? Like you might also have to increase the number of workers, like health workers who are engaging in these calls, because ultimately this would be like a resource allocation problem. Like you said, like, so you are using AI to find the right time to intervene. But in this case, like if you are scaling up to 1 million users, the ratio will also have to increase. Is that correct? Or do you think that the model would still be able to find the most effective ways to use the existing set of resources, in this case, workers?
Right. No, you're absolutely right. Like if there are much more enrollments happening, there are much more women enrolled in the program, we would proportionally need much more health workers, but that's not possible because there's a limited set of health workers. So we're also now looking at another program, which is run by the same NGO at a much more massive scale. And we realize that this approach alone is not enough to improve engagement. And now we're looking at other problems as well, like when to send out these phone calls, the automated voice messages. Like I mentioned, that many women don't own their own phone. So kind of inferring from data and listenership patterns, when is the right time to call them? And boost listenership. And this way, it's more of an automated intervention. Does not require any manual intervention. And so more strategic call planning, basically. And so we're right now in the process of figuring out, diving into the data and figuring out what are the patterns and what are the right problems to work on. But you're absolutely right that the call center approach is scalable only to a certain extent.
Yeah. And one of the key things that, like, for me or maybe someone for you, it would be interesting is, like, I want to also learn, like, a lot of people don't exactly know how, like, when we say, like, we are using AI for a particular application, they find it interesting. But I think it takes a human, inhuman effort to, like, actually work with this kind of data, right? Like scope, like, once we define the problem, the real work starts. And that becomes, like, a huge chaos when you are working with, let's say, NGOs, where things are not necessarily in the most structured form. Because when we are working with big corps, like the data is much more structured because there's a business value out of it. So what kind of things have you noticed? Like, because you are the one person or maybe like a team of people who are working on these things, I can imagine like it would take a lot of amount of work to like even prune out data, clean out data that like AI model can smoothly run on it. So what kind of insights do you have? Like what kind of things would you say most people don't know about working with these kind of data sets? What does it take to actually do the data engineering or data pre-processing pipelines?
That's an excellent question. It is as real as it gets. So this is, when you say real world social impact, this is a big, big part of it. To really understand, the data will be noisy. The data will be sparse. There will be other issues, like just like you mentioned, we were running a study and we discovered things were not going as planned. And after doing some investigations and discussing with the NGO, we figured some variable changed in the back end of their database and we were suddenly noticing something else. But this is, again, thanks to our deep collaboration with them, we can have these honest conversations and figure out. But yes, things like this happen. There was another case where we were noticing abrupt changes in listenership patterns, like spikes and so forth, which was being caused due to network outages. The data was not being stored correctly. And and then there are issues like, this is not really NGO related, but if there is a network issue, this is now not dependent on the beneficiary at all, right? If the network is been loaded or congested or whatever the calls can go through. So, so you have missing data, and there is so much more. These are real people with real lives, you know, dealing with other children in the family and a job and whatnot. And you're trying to, you know, predict listenership behaviors based on just some calls they've heard in the past. Yes, so you have, like I said, while we have a lot of passive data, you know, from the automated voice messages, but we have very limited active data. So when the interventions were made, because yes, the health workers have been reaching out to women, but there is still a limited number of interventions that have happened. So there's very limited data around what happens when you receive an intervention. So again, that extrapolation needs to be done. It needs to be scalable. You want this system to be actually deployed by the NGO in the end. It should not just be a cool research paper that you publish and you're done with. You actually want the NGO to deploy this system in the long run. So it has to be sustainable. So it can't be, you know, these approaches shouldn't be data heavy. They shouldn't be compute heavy. And you have to understand it and appreciate and, you know, just accept the underlying challenges that, yes, our models have to be robust to the uncertainties that are inherently present in the data. Whatever you learn will be, you know, within certain confidence intervals. Embrace these as research challenges rather than think of them as limitations.
Yeah. And when you spot these kind of inconsistencies in data, is it like, do you communicate back towards people who are leading these projects? So let's say in this case, NGOs from Arman, like, because I think like the reason I ask this question, I think it takes also domain expertise to understand how to normalize these data sets, right? Like, let's say, I mean, the typical ways to understand how we can fill the data or we can prune out the data, right? Like these are the two things that we can do. So who like how do you approach this particular problem, as in, do you communicate back like, okay, we are using a technique that can maybe fill the data with some kind of dummy values, but would that be good or not? Would that mean something else in this particular problem statement? So do you communicate back, or how do you approach
this? Absolutely. So this has been a wonderful collaboration. We actually have weekly meetings with the NGO, you know, sharing progress, anything we discover we communicate back. And like I said, they helped us debug some of these issues as to why this spiky behavior could be happening. And them being the domain experts will think of something quickly that, oh, it was because there was this network outage and something went wrong, but we fixed that.
Yeah.
We couldn't have figured that out on our own. And yeah, so there is definitely a lot of feedback from both ends. We rely on their expertise, they rely on our expertise. So it has to be an synergy. And back.
I was just trying to ask, as in, like, how do you approach, because most of these problems, a lot of people would be interested in working for like AI for good kind of projects, but the right I think the right amount of expertise goes into understanding and scoping out these problems. So what kind of things do you keep in mind when you're working on, let's say, if I present you a problem, this is a problem of a, like, let's say, real world scenario, but like, how do you scope out the problems, like defining which kind of components of this particular problem that I can approach using AI, versus there are also, like, I think even in this project there would be lots of things that can be improved using AI. For example, the whole data normalizing thing, you can itself make a project out of it that how we can more reliably collect data. So how do you scope out the perfect component that can really make the biggest impact?
So, just to give an example, like, we started with this RMAB model, and that alone, during the process of training the model, doing all this analysis, coming up with the metrics on our own to understand what is really going on, it unraveled so many interesting research challenges, and that spun off into, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 different research projects, just starting from this one key problem.
Yeah.
And you really have to dive deep into the data to really understand what's going on. Like I said, there is no standard data sets here. There's no ground truth here. You know, there's no ground truth human behavior. So you have to really use a lot of your own creativity in the analysis to understand what metrics should be come up with to understand what's going on. What is the model really doing? What are we actually trying to optimize for? and then look at the data and try to understand if it's even feasible from the amount of data we have, because sometimes it's just not.
Yeah.
And if there are, then what are the limitations? How can we address those limitations? So for instance, when we were doing this approach, we learned that for some people, we can have very reliable predictions, but for some people, the predictions may not be as accurate. So we had, for instance, learned from historic data, transition probabilities. What is the probability that this person, if was given an intervention, would start listening to calls? Or yeah. If were not given an intervention, they're a good listener, they would keep listening on their own. But then when you notice after the study, in some cases, this was not matching what we had predicted. Despite an intervention, people did not change their behavior. Without an intervention, people improve their behavior. So what's going on? And so we realize our model is not perfect. And what could be the reasons for it? One could be that distribution shift. We've learned from past data and maybe the current set of people. People are not going to behave exactly the same as they have always been. You know, behaviors evolve over time. So how do we model that? We cannot capture all sorts of behaviors. So for certain people, you can learn with more confidence. For others, the confidence is less. So how do you take those confidence intervals into account when making those predictions? What is the value in learning online? So you already have a prior, but how do you keep updating this information and so forth? So I think it was just really, really diving into the problem. And thanks to that field study, which helped us collect real data, which I know is not always possible. We're very lucky to have such collaborators, which helped us organize such a study, which led to all this analysis, which then led to all these interesting new research problems. We were fortunate enough to have had that experience.
Yeah. I can relate to only few part of it, because like I think I have been working with a lot of doctors who collect these kind of data sets. And I mean, this is comparatively relatively very sophisticated environment, because people are enrolling into these studies. But even with those scenarios, like people with so much trained expertise, it's very hard to like miss a lot of things, because like let's say you walk into a hospital and you fill out few data. There are so many variations of what people fill out this information versus, let's say, if I went to the hospital versus you went to the hospital, in what scenarios you are filling out this information. And when we use these data to make analysis or prediction models, you have to analyze a lot of things. And the most important thing is like missing data. Not a lot of people would fill out this information correctly. So how do you analyze for that? Like how do you fix and most importantly, what kind of techniques you use so that the model is not learning something aberrant, like that is not useful pattern in this particular scenario. And in your case, it would be like much more harder, because like these come from people who might not have that much expertise in understanding that this data has to be that much clean. So yeah, it takes a, I think, Herculean task for people who are working with collecting and managing these data sets. So yeah, and that begs me the question, as in like, I mean, this would be like a very known question, but I still want to get some insights from you. Is like, do you feel there is a disconnect between people like you who are work, like who has a immense amount of expertise working from the technical side or algorithmic side, versus people who are from, let's say in your case, Arman, who do not have that much expertise. They do not know how exactly what goes into building these models and cleaning up the data. What do you think really makes an efficient collaboration between these two distinct fields? Because like you said, like the most amount of impact comes when you are working on real world problems. But the biggest problem is people who are facilitators, right? Like you, who can facilitate these kind of two interdisciplinary fields. What do you think? Like, first of all, do you think there is a disconnect between tech fields and non-tech fields where the impact has to be bigger? And what kind of key things would you say that makes an efficient collaboration?
Right. I wouldn't go so far as say there's a disconnect, but I do believe that there is definitely scope for improvement in connections. And like the workshop that Google conducted to bring together these interdisciplinary experts was a stepping stone towards that. And we could see now at many AI research conferences, there are dedicated tracks for AI for good and workshops and in this domain. So there is a lot more research and active collaborations happening, but I still feel there is definitely a need for a forum which brings together NGOs and AI experts and all sorts of interdisciplinary experts to kind of really help build more of these collaborations and it become an ecosystem on its own where people can find the right partners to work with. So I do feel there is definitely a scope for something like that. And you said what goes into building, yeah. I think this is just trusting, it's like any relationship, having trust in your partner. Having trust in your partner that they are the real domain experts. They are the ones who have direct, you know, interactions with the community and they understand what really works and what's feasible and what is the real objective to be solved. Because from a distance, we have, us as AI experts, have no clue. To us, it's just numbers on a, you know, engagement numbers and whatever, like this call listenership data. If I were to look at that, that doesn't explain to me how, you know, what that really translates to in the real world. And similarly, it's for them, they have to trust us as well. So I think that goes a long way. But it has to be that the NGO has a good understanding, basically, of the community they're working with and the kind of data they have, how responsible they are in capturing data. How aware they are of how important it is to, you know, follow certain data protocols, follow and have the right ethical questions in mind to also, you know, to ask us while building on these models. So, yeah, and I think, that's all I can say.
Yeah, no, true. In my limited experience also, I think what makes an efficient collaboration between two different interdisciplinary fields of sciences is like there is an understanding between both the fields, like for the equal expertise. So I think when I work with doctors, there are people who really understand that they might not know the whole whole background behind AI, but they know that how a brief or an abstract idea of AI is. And how it can impact that particular field. And even like me coming from a computer science background, I know, or I don't understand essentially like how migraine works or Alzheimer's work, but I understand like how AI can be used to locate some of the patterns and it could be useful for doctors. I in my experience, I have seen like there's an abstract understanding of both the fields and they are just trying to work together. And I think it's a step-by-step approach. Like once you communicate with them more, you present your results and based on your understanding, then they say, okay, this is not good, but maybe we can explore this way. So it builds like a step-by-step approach. And over the years, I think something fruitful comes out of it. But yeah, there is a very hidden understanding of what the other fields do. And then, yeah, it builds on top of that. So yeah, I just to second that. Yeah, I mean, what you said totally makes sense. Trust is really important for sure. So yeah. And personally, like, so asking questions from a personal endpoint. So like, what motivates you the most? As in, would you say the theoretical part of AI research motivates you the most, or is it the application standpoint? Like, are you more intrigued onto building an efficient algorithm that can beat the state-of-art results that have been reported in a table somewhere? Or do you think the application point of view, like something what you said, like at Arman, like you are trying to impact real-world metrics that might not be reported somewhere else? What motivates you more?
So, on the one hand, I would say both motivate me, of course, right? I'm in research here, so I want to do cool research and make, you know, fundamental contributions to research, which is applicable much more beyond what, you know, how it started, and not just for the collaboration with Arman, but much more beyond that. And of course, to have real impact. If I'm very honest, I'm more driven by the real impact of this. Because, of course, research is great and it's important. And, you know, we've done a PhD, we've published papers. It's time to have real. For me, it's the impact that really drives me, especially in this particular case. I think it's very close to my heart. So, yes, I am more passionate towards.
Yeah.
Actually, so for every research project that emerges. And we have our team. So we have Professor Milan Tame, who's, you know, more from the academic side, there's me from Google. So it's a good mix of people who are kind of, you know, motivated by both research and impact. So we kind of keep reminding each other, what is the research value of this project and what is the actual, you know, could this lead to real impact or not? So it has to be a good mix of both. But yes, I'm always cognizant of whether this can actually be, you know, when we start a project, even if it's an intern coming to us, I tell them, can you think of it that at some point we could try this out in a field study and actually, you know, deploy it in the real world? That has to be, at least there has to be that motivation. Of course, not everything. Some things start out theoretical and then they may or may not end up getting tested in the real world. But yeah, that motivation should be there.
Yeah, makes sense. I think that makes two of us, because I second that particular opinion, because even for me, I definitely want to make sure that I make some kind of fundamental contributions to the field while I'm working on my PhD. But at the same time, like, the personal motivation always comes when you see that there's a real world impact, like a tangible impact that you can feel. And correct me if I'm wrong. So like, as in when I would say, when you're working on these kind of projects, what research skills? Because I feel most of the time, people who are working on fundamental research, the problem set is very much limited, as in like in terms of data. Like, let's say most of the computer vision projects in the initial days, they were focused on MNIST datasets, CIFAR datasets. And there are some fantastic works that have been proposed when you use like a benchmark of dataset. Yeah. But the focus of researcher solely lies on the algorithmic side of training the models or getting, but the data set remains very constrained. But when we are working on these kind of projects, which have like so many to-do tasks, even from the data perspective, when we work on these, there's a different kind of expertise that person can build. So do you have any insights for what kind of skills a researcher should have that makes him or her good in these kind of settings, which are much more, you know, crude settings, because you have to deal with a lot of messiness of the data, a lot of messiness of the results, which because like we know, bad data, bad results, garbage in, garbage out. That's the rule of machine learning. So what research skills, looking back, you think have made you good at what you are doing, and that makes a good collaboration when you're working with moving target scenarios, right? Like, you just keep on working and the results don't feel good. So it just keeps on getting away from you. So what research skills do you think are the most efficient ones?
So there are some skills that I think I've picked up during my PhD is resilience and patience of keep trying and trying and trying. And at some point, you know, something will work, but to keep trying. Learn to fail fast, try things and move on when it's not the right thing. And in this particular case, you're absolutely right. There is no golden data. There's no absolute metrics you're trying to reach out for. So in this particular case, I would really say strong analytical skills and the creativity to really, you know, make sense of this extremely messy, noisy, sparse data. To see where are the gaps in performance, what are the potential buckets that we could improve? Do we have the data to address those challenges? So really a lot of creativity in coming up with the right analytics to understand the data and then come up with the solution. Like, the modeling part is much later. First is understanding what is the problem that we should be working on requires a lot of strong analytical skills. And this is something, you're right, I did not experience that much in the past when I was working in vision related problems. That was just given. The data set was, there was labels and everything. And just like I said, resilience and patience of keep trying. And
I agree to two particular points a lot. I think the strong analytics instinct is really important, because that's something I have been learning a lot, because my professor is from industrial engineering. So she has a lot of background in like the core statistics, right? Like, I mean, it's like it goes beyond what we are taught in as a computer science student, because at computer science student, we are just typically working on the standard machine learning models, mathematics, coding, programming, and other deep learning projects. But when in the initial days, I'll present some results, and she would find out like some kind of correlation metric that I've never heard. And she would try to present this and say, oh, this is what it means when we correlate this particular feature set with these kind of results and these kind of surrogate results that we can get out of it. And I was like, yeah, that like this is something I think makes research more interesting, because having to take like these kind of very simplistic statistics measure that can tell a lot of more about data. And yeah, being creative about it is, I think, comes with some kind of practice. I think like you deal with a lot of messiness.
Yeah. It's a skill you build as you work with this. And it's really, really, it's a skill that will take you a long way in any other project that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other part you said, like, I think patience and resilience that you learned as a PhD. So what were the factors that you considered before doing a PhD? Did you have any second thoughts before doing a PhD? As in, did you want to go to the industry straight after your bachelor's? Or like, what was the point that you considered that made you go for a PhD?
So actually, after my bachelor's, I went straight to an industrial research lab. I was working with Sarnoff, which is associated with SRI. And like I said, they were working on these automotive applications. So it was a good mix of, you know, applied stuff with interesting research going behind it. And as a part of the process, I would read a lot of papers to see what's the state of the art and what we could implement. And that's where I read a lot of papers written by my professor. And that's what got me excited. And I felt like after a while, And of course, I was a young, you know, junior young researcher back then. I felt after a while things were getting repetitive, and I really felt the need to learn more and really, grow my knowledge of the subject beyond that specific application that I was working on. And so that's how I kind of chose the research path. The PhD path, and I don't regret it. Very often people ask me, oh, you're at Google now and you don't work on any sort of, you know, vision, and your PhD has gone to waste. And I don't think so, because just like we discussed, knowledge never goes waste, I think. And you build so many more skills that you can think of. Like, you know, when people think of a PhD, of course you think you'll have lots of papers and you're really, you know, an expert of the field. What you don't, you also learn a lot of other skills. Time management, working for deadlines. Like I said, resilience, patience, trying and failing, and you know, getting better at it. So all of that collectively makes you an excellent researcher. So
yeah, and most importantly, I think one of the key things is taking ownership of a project. That I think I feel like in industry, I think there is also the same case. But as a PhD student, you're the person who is like proposing the topic in itself, and the idea that like you take ownership of that project. So even if that project fails, like you learn how to reiterate on that particular thesis topic or whatever you're trying to propose, and then you improve on that one, and then you again take up this project. I think that is really critical, because it's like literally just you have one person working on that one and advisor occasionally trying to make sure that you don't fail, which is not guaranteed always, but yeah, I mean that's the idea.
Yes.
So yeah.
On the other hand, I feel with industry, it depends from person to person. Like some people like really like to, like you said, take ownership of a thing and really go deep into it and, you know, build that expert knowledge, which you can also do in the industry. It's not feasible there. Some people like to, you know, quickly move on and try new things and explore new things and, build new skills. And that is something you can do in industry. Like you can change teams, change projects more quickly, or have basically exposure into a lot more projects. So that has its own value as well.
Yeah. But looking back, do you think still, like, I think a lot of people are involved in AI research in industry with various degrees of expertise. So do you think PhD provides like a significant advantage? I mean, you definitely commented on the patience and resilience. It teaches you that. But do you think it has anything more in terms of requirements? Like, do you still feel like a lot of roles have the minimum requirements for having a PhD when you're working on these skills? So do you think still having a PhD in 2023 is good for people aiming for AI research roles in industry?
It's difficult now because things have changed now with, you know, research labs growing so much and so much exciting work happening within industry research as well. You have a lot of exposure into very exciting projects that you don't necessarily need to be in a, you know, academic research environment to get that level of exposure. But I still feel that where a PhD adds value is because you build that foundational knowledge and really, you know, grow incrementally and understand the field in and out. And this is something else. Keep my mind. Never mind. If I think of it. And
that's fine. We can reiterate. I get the idea. I think like being in the PhD program, you get to study the fundamental research or the idea of state of art literature much more in depth, and the reason for that is like you are trying to push out a thesis topic, push out to peer-reviewed journals or conferences, and that inherently more incentivizes you to read the literature much more in depth, and that is much more comprehensive of the whole field rather than when we are industry. I think you might be still working on a whole set of problems, but we are targeting one particular narrow approach, so I think we might be limited to that one. Not necessarily that's a bad thing, but it just provides a different perspective to the problem.
And I feel it also increases your exposure to ambiguity in problems. Research is, I mean, that is the whole point, right? To really attack difficult problems that many may not choose. Yeah. And that you thrive in ambiguity, that excites you, that you don't know, you know, what the data is telling you. You don't know what the problem is. You're figuring all of that out, and that should excite you. And that's, again, a skill that comes in handy when you're in industry research as well. And having done a PhD, you get that a lot. So,
true.
You don't, you know, it doesn't scare you, it doesn't intimidate you, it excites you.
True. And what were the...
For many people, they prefer, I've seen, and again, there's nothing wrong with that, but many people prefer to work on, you know, like well-defined problems where there's kind of, you can see there's a path to a solution, and that's totally fine as well. But the confidence to kind of attack an ambiguous, difficult, unknown problem is, I think having a PhD helps in that sense. Of course, you can, again, if you're in a good lab, you know, you get lucky to be in an amazing project with, you know, amazing mentors, you will build all those skills in an industry lab as well. But in a PhD, it's more the norm. So
It's more bottom up, I would say, in academia. So like you take control of it. So And what were the factors that you considered when you moved out of your PhD? Like, what were the factors you considered to not join academia and then joining industry? Like, were there any personal factors that you consider? And like, the reason I ask this question is like to maybe help people who might be making that decision. But like, I mean, I can understand the personal question. But did you evaluate the pros and cons of both the things for yourself? I know this would be a personal opinion, so feel free to share if you want.
Absolutely. I thought, you know, I had my heart set on being in academia, and then I got invited to I found out about some interesting lab opening at Google in the topic that I was working on during my PhD, and then I suddenly got tempted and confused because here is some exciting work which, you know, I really enjoy. So what difference does it make whether I'm in academia or in industry, when I'm doing cool research, it shouldn't matter, you know, where it's happening. So I was confused, and then I found out I was expecting. and that kind of, that is challenging to know that you'll be, you know, going through a difficult period, then you'll be away for a while, coming back, rebuilding. So I think then you want to be in an atmosphere where it's, it just felt more comfortable or more, more long-term, like a more sustainable option. And I remember I was so torn apart. I was like, what should I do? And I would never do that. I just called up my PhD advisor. I was almost in tears. I was like, what should I do? I'm so confused. And he said, if you're going to Google, what are you complaining about? So you should just, he mentioned that, and his kind of prediction came right, that you'd be back in research whenever you want on the kind of problems you want to. And, you know, being in Google, you have the flexibility to change teams. You work on a project, you find that exciting, great. If not, 2 years later, you move to something else. So, and that's kind of what happened. So.
Yeah, true. No, that makes sense. I think I was talking to my advisor a few days back, and she said the same thing. As in 15 years back, that was not the case. If you wanted to work on some very exciting projects, academia used to be the place where you have the creativity of thought. People, like, if you're good enough, you get funded and you can pursue those works. But in industry, it used to be like, I mean, quote unquote, mundane work that normally people having a PhD won't be applying for. But nowadays, I think there are very exciting problems that I think industry, like, in fact, I think most of the conference this industry people are the ones that are publishing and innovating the benchmark more than I think academia, which is a good thing. So it helps you work on these projects and innovate while being in the industry. So I mean, definitely, like you said, like your advisor said, it worked out good for you. So you can still have best of both the worlds. So you're much more stable over here.
I mean, of course, there's, you know, being in academia, it's wonderful. Being able to drive your own research agenda and having that independence is also amazing. But yes, I was at a point in my life that I felt this was the more sensible decision long term. And like you said, research wise, opportunities wise, it is just as exciting, if not more exciting. So fine. And I get to collaborate now with academic partners as well. Thanks to Professor Dambe. We have an extended team with Harvard PhD students and postdocs. So, I kind of get to experience both.
Yeah, true. I also talked to Dr. Tambe. Like, I think his vision on both the aspects of like application of AI and a theoretical understanding of AI is very rigorous, and he's very down to it. That's like one of the key things that like stands out when you talk to him. So it's like having those kind of collaborations, like it's good. Like you get to experience like the good part of AI projects. So yeah, definitely that's a good thing. One of the other questions that I had is, like, I think a lot of people would not know how to manage work duties, like people who are working, because as a person who like I'm working on research problems, I often find it very hard to find time for myself, as in, like, I'd be working from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. even till 11 p.m. at nights. And for someone who's working like you full time, maybe possibly with a family and kids, how do you particularly manage these kind of projects where you have moving deadlines? Like, it's not specific that you work from 9 to 5, at 5 p.m. you close your laptops and you go on to other works. So how do you manage timelines? And secondly, how do you keep up with the other parts of your life, which is more important? So
that's a very valid question, and it's a skill I am building over time. So for instance, so I have two small kids and I love to spend time with them. And I work a lot with folks in the US. I am based in India, so that's a lot of different time zone meetings. So I try to divide my day now into chunks. Like, I try to have early morning meetings with US folks. Then, of course, the rest of the day, the usual working hours, business hours with the India team. And in the evening, I try to block off time, which sometimes people don't adhere to, but I try my best to kind of block out that time for my kids and for myself. Because then again, I have meetings in the night after I put kids to bed. And a lot of times it's funny that people feel guilty. They're like, oh, we kept you late at night. We're sorry you're having such a late meeting. And I say, no, that I actually prefer this because now I don't feel guilty. The kids are in bed. But yes, this is a skill like I had to learn because it's very tempting to say yes, you know. And sometimes it's difficult to schedule meetings with lots of people across different time zones, different constraints, right? So not every time your constraints can be followed, but I'm very grateful to be in a very understanding team who've offered me that flexibility. But yes, it's important to kind of mark that time for yourself. Even if you're a young researcher and don't need to have kids to have time for yourself, you deserve that time to yourself. Yeah. So I think you have to do it yourself. If you have to respect your time before anyone else respects your time, right? So that is a lesson you learn when you're older. not just self-care, but yeah, time for things that really matter. Because
And I think it's also very important. Like when you're working on research projects, a lot of times what goes unsaid is like you have to be in that zone, right? Like I think most of the times, like even if you sit for 9 to 5, it doesn't mean that you would be solving that particular problem. Like you have to be in that zone to understand what's going on. Like you could be just wasting your time for most of the times, and then something hits and you particularly solve that problem. So it's not like a stipulated amount of work that you do every 15 minutes or 20 minutes. You have to be in that zone trying to understand. You read a lot of stuff, and then like let's say if the timer goes off, like you just come out of that zone and then blank. It's something that doesn't happen. So I think building up that zone is very important. You have to be, and it becomes very hard, like you said, like with other priorities and responsibilities in life. So
No, you're absolutely right. Because if you have that routine kind of where you know there is demarcated time for work and for self and whatever activities that is you have, then you are kind of you're trained to switch context like that. When you're this is work time, this is focus on work. And when it's not, you try to disconnect. I know it's not easy, but yes.
Yeah, that was my actually next question. I was trying to ask, like, even if like it's very easy to build up these slots on calendars, right? Like, let's say 9 to 5 this, but and 5 to 7 this. But it's very hard to switch that. Like, it's very hard to follow those kind of routines, right? Like for me, that's very hard. Like even if I say like, okay, 5 to 7 for me, like it's a gym time. Like how many times do I really actually do that? Like I'll be switching or maybe blurring those boundaries into that. Okay, maybe I can just give up today. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow. So like. Yeah. I don't know. Like, does that become better with time? Like, you are trying to much more religiously follow those timelines. And okay, I'll do it.
Like I said, it's a skill I'm still building, so I am definitely trying. But I know I have to. Like, I love spending time with my kids, and it's something for me. I have to really prioritize that. So I do make an effort. I do decline meetings sometimes in the evenings. Sometimes I'll accept, like I said, sometimes it's just difficult to follow everyone's constraints and find a time for everyone together.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to say, no, this makes is sense. Critical time and you have to value it.
Makes sense. And I think to wrap up, I have like one of the favorite questions I normally tend to ask, like all of the guests I invite on my podcast is, typically, when I started this podcast, it was to cater to people who are much more new to the field of AI. And the biggest, I would say, confusion that people have is they are interested in AI because AI has a huge potential to work with data and provide some insights. But at the same time, nowadays, AI is so much complicated. Like there are so many things that people can work in AI, and people get demotivated by understanding which fields they are interested in, right? Like there are vision, language, reinforcement learning, robotics, lots of things. So what kind of advice would you have for someone who is fairly interested in AI, trying to get started, but overwhelmed to understand where exactly can I start? And like you said, like for someone like you, who's working on AI for social good, which is like a good, like a feel good moment for applying and working on these problems. The first question is like, how do I navigate into this field of like so much developments every week? And secondly, how do I contribute to projects that create a good impact that makes me motivated to work on these projects?
So regarding your first question of how to navigate in this overwhelming research domains, NLU, vision, robotics, etc. I take the approach of explore and exploit in reinforcement learning. So I would say, act on your strengths, but don't stop exploring. Use whatever opportunities you get, whether it's attending a summer camp or a tech talk or doing an internship. Keep exploring, because you never know, the next thing may be much more exciting than the current thing. So especially for young researchers, you're far too young to kind of constrain yourselves to one thing or just follow the trend, mindlessly. Really follow your passion, because when you really enjoy what you do, the results will just naturally come flow.
So
of course you can't keep trying, can't keep switching as well. That's why I say explore and exploit. Do something safe for whatever is that you build some experience on, but find every opportunity to explore as well. A lot of Google has this PhD seminar summits, find whatever venues possible to learn more and more from the experts, whether it's through such talks or through a direct experience like an internship, which is amazing. So keep doing that.
Yeah, I think, exploring gives you the most amount of exposure to understanding what really you would like, versus, because I think a lot of things, when you work, you pick up one field, let's say vision or language, there are so many things that you might not like about that particular field when you start working on them. But at the end, you try to understand what are the rewards. Using the reinforcement learning terms, is like what kind of rewards you would be getting working on these technologies. Yes. And some of the things you just get by through, for some, it could be programming. I have talked to a lot of researchers. For them, programming is just one of the tools to get forward, they don't enjoy or they don't get the kick out of it, but they really get good at implementing stuff just for the sake of need of it. So I think those kind of realizations you only have when you start working on these projects. And most of the times I would say they happen to be like you said, summer camp projects. Like they don't have to be an industry where your job depends on it or something, because you learn in the most crude environments.
Yeah. Yeah, hackathons or whatever venue you can find, kind of expose yourself to interesting new research directions.
But that makes sense. Thanks for sharing that.
I think for me, because for instance, after my undergrad, I chose to work and then chose to do a PhD, because many people just go to a PhD right after. It made me appreciate it even more. So, when I stepped foot back into a university attending lectures, it was just an amazing feeling too, because it's something I chose, intentionally. Yeah. So then that's a really rewarding experience. And I did courses which I was not supposed to do. I would just go sit in lectures just for the sake of learning. And like I said, my PhD was not in machine learning, but I attended courses because I knew it was such a fascinating field. It was growing so fast. Attend conferences if you can. I know it's difficult to, it's not always possible, but if virtually or however.
And I think most importantly, attending these kind of talks or maybe something that's out of your expertise or interest, I think it also builds to some kind of unique, like you said, like the creative collaborations, right? Like if you, I think I was attending this one talk from electrical engineering on game theory. And that was something that I understood, maybe we can use some kind of game theoretic approaches to understanding how the model predictions work. And there's already one work out there, like the Shapley values one, which uses game theoretic approaches to explain how a model would have worked. And they use the number of players in a particular scenario, which in this case in machine learning model would be number of features. So these kind of things I think really really can be explored when you are trying to explore things out of your interest. So yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, all right. Thanks for sharing that. I think those are the questions that I had for this particular podcast. So I think, yeah, I we get to cover a lot. And one of the few key things that I think I really like about your profile is you're working on this project that has like a real world impact. And I think most of the works that you have published, it clearly shows that. So thanks for sharing that. I think people who would be listening would be really interested in learning how Google Research and your team AI for Social Good is actually using something that has a positive impact to the society and reaching out to that many people. So yeah, I think it would be, I hope it was useful for people who are listening to this particular podcast. And I'll be leaving a link to your profile so like people can check out more work of yours and your team at Google Research in India. But thanks again for being on the podcast. I think it's late night for you, so thanks a lot for being on an inhuman hour and bearing with my questions. But
it was wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for being here.